stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Suicide car bombing in Baghdad kills 91. A suicide car bombing at a busy shopping area in Baghdad today has killed at least 83 people and wounded more than 170 others. Islamic State has claimed responsibility. A second deadly blast occurred in eastern Baghdad, killing at least one person, wounding several others. There's been no official claim of responsibility. The Islamic State did claim responsibility for that late Friday siege on an upscale Dhaka restaurant. The hostage crisis at a restaurant in Bangladesh's capital left 28 dead, including 20 hostages and 6 militants. Most of the radical Islamist attacks occurring in the mostly moderate, mostly Muslim country have been claimed by the Islamic State group or by al-Qaeda, but the government vehemently denies these jihadi groups have any presence in the country at all. Asaduddin Khan is the interior minister in Bangladesh.
I am telling you, all the Bangladeshi are against it, and definitely we shall uproot all the terrorists from Bangladesh. Thank you.
ISIS?
You see, this is 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 a slogan. There is no existence of IS. This homegrown terrorist wants to contact with IS. This is the main thing. But all are our homegrown, our national. It is not from other countries. It is all our national, our people.
Reuters quotes the national police chief saying 7 militants were all from Bangladesh. An 18-year-old man is accused of conspiring to carrying out acts of terrorism against government buildings in the southwest U.S. state of Arizona. The FBI and the Attorney General's office in Arizona say 18-year-old Maheen Khan was arrested following an investigation by the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force. This is VOA News. Some influential American lawmakers and other officials have begun a trip to Pakistan by meeting with the country's military chief to discuss the situation in Afghanistan and efforts to strengthen Pakistan's border security. Speaking prior to the Americans' visit, Army spokesman Lieutenant General Asim Bajwa insisted that Islamabad is committed to cracking down on militant groups involved in the Afghan conflict.
Pakistan is not at all sheltering anyone. And Pakistan is not aiding anyone, is not allowing its soil to be used for attacks across the border.
Relations between Washington and Islamabad have particularly deteriorated after the May 21st U.S. drone strike that killed the leader of the Afghan Taliban, Mullah Akhtar Mansour, in Pakistan. Afghanistan has received its first batch of Chinese military equipment as part of Beijing's commitment to provide millions of dollars of assistance to help Kabul fight terrorism. The shipment on board a Russian cargo plane arrived Sunday in Kabul, where Chinese Ambassador Yao Jing handed it over to Afghan National Security Advisor Hanif Atmar. U.S. Democratic Party presidential candidate Hillary Clinton met with FBI officials on Saturday about the use of a private email server while she was Secretary of State. The three-hour meeting followed Attorney General Loretta Lynch's announcement of her intent to accept recommendations from career Justice Department employees and federal agents looking into Clinton's use of a private email server. Lynch's remarks follow an impromptu meeting she'd had with Secretary Clinton's husband, former President Bill Clinton, days earlier, that raised questions voiced by Republican lawmakers about if the email investigation had been compromised. Lynch has said the meeting had no bearing on how the matter is being reviewed. Elie Wiesel, who survived the Nazi death camps during World War II to become a world-renowned author and Nobel Peace Prize winner, has died at the age of 87. Wiesel won the 1986 Nobel Peace Prize for speaking out against war, discrimination. He also kept alive the memories of the Holocaust and also spoke out against the suppression of human rights.
We teach by example. We live as examples. If we could reduce the hate in one person, I think that in itself would create a difference for the whole world. I believe in that whatever we do leaves a trace somewhere.
President Obama called Wiesel a dear friend who was one of the great moral voices of our time. For more on all these stories, visit our website at voanews.com. Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
It's not a celebration, this is a memorial. The memorial marking the 40th anniversary of that operation. And you know, memorials are for different things. So I think there's a misunderstanding that it's a celebration.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visits Uganda on Monday to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the Entebbe raid.
This is actually also a wake-up call for the political leaders themselves to remind their cadres that Zambia is a multi-party state. And that being the case, each and every person is free to form a political party.
A Zambian police official warns political parties over escalating violence in the run-up to the elections.
And we are looking the international community, our international partners, to help us, all these menace, all these non-state actors who are creating problems for peace and stability in the region and also for peace and stability in worldwide.
And the president of Puntland says he is committed to the fight to defeat Al-Shabaab. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni will meet Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Monday to commemorate the Israeli raid on Entebbe 40 years ago. Invited heads of state to participate in the commemoration include the President of South Sudan, Rwanda, Zambia, Tanzania, Kenya, Malawi, and the Ethiopian Prime Minister. According to the government, plans for the occasion does not include arrangements to honor on-duty soldiers the Israeli commandos killed in 1976 during the raid. For more, I reached Ambassador James Mugumi, the Permanent Secretary at the Ugandan Foreign Ministry.
The commemoration marking the 40th anniversary of Operation Jonathan took place 40 years ago during the raid on Entebbe, which many people have seen in the movie. After that, the Prime Minister will meet a number of heads of state here, and then we have a bilateral visit as well. We discuss areas of cooperation with Israel. So he's also visited a number of countries in the region, including Ethiopia and China.
Ambassador, what would you say has been the relationship so far between Israel and Uganda?
We've been having very good relations, and the cooperating areas of agriculture and capacity building, and we have had an ambassador credited to Uganda, and we have had our ambassador in Cairo credited to Israel.
I was reading some dailies in the Ugandan newspapers, and they're saying during the raid, some Ugandans were killed who were fighting to protect the territorial integrity of Uganda. So it should not be celebrated on Monday, as some people are doing. Diplomatically, how is that possible if the Israeli Prime Minister is visiting and holding discussions, bilateral discussions at that, with President Yoweri Museveni and the government?
It's not a celebration. This is a memorial. A memorial marking the 40th anniversary of that operation. And you know, memorials are for different things. So I think there's a misunderstanding that it's a celebration. It's a memorial. And it's an event that took place in the circumstances where there had been hijacking, but also recognized and security council did take note about the sovereignty of state. But this is a commemoration, it's not a celebration.
Looking at the commemoration on Monday, how does that play in Uganda's fight against terrorism in the region and in Africa as a whole?
You know, we'll be looking at issues of terrorism as a threat to international regional peace and security. And so the regional emphasis will be marked because there will be the presidents of Kenya, Ethiopia, Rwanda, they will also be here. And we are looking at the issue of combating terrorism, including cybersecurity, information gathering, and confronting all the aspects, including capacity building in that area.
Going forward, what do you see the relationship between Jerusalem and Kampala in the near future?
I think I'll see some more work in terms of new avenues of cooperation, particularly in the area of capacity building, utilization of new technologies, including renewable energies and sustainable development, and transfer of technology, ICT. So these are, I see, more cooperation in that area.
Ambassador James Mugume is the Permanent Secretary at the Ugandan Foreign Ministry. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. President Joseph Kabila is due to step down as a head of state of the Democratic Republic of Congo in December, but it is looking increasingly likely that this year's election will be delayed. Statement this week by the president and the lead opposition figure, now in exile, underscore the uncertainty of the Central African national's political future and the potential flashpoints ahead. For VOA, William Klaus has more from the capital, Kinshasa.
President Joseph Kabila's Independence Day speech was pre-recorded, as usual. Kabila is a famously reluctant public speaker, but his words were anything but timid. The defiant head of state summoned the Congolese people to resist what he called untimely and unlawful foreign interference. He repeatedly praised his security services. His comments are seen as a direct response to targeted sanctions imposed by the US government on one of Kabila's most senior police chiefs on June 23rd. The US government, as well as members of Congress, have accused the Kabila government of deliberately delaying elections that should take place in November and of cracking down on the opposition and civil society. Further sanctions may be forthcoming. This was supposed to be Kabila's final Independence Day as president. The nation's constitution limits him to 2 terms in office, but it is looking unlikely the polls will be held this year. The Electoral Commission says it needs more than a year to prepare the voter rolls, and the Constitutional Court ruled in May that Kabila can stay in power until the election is held. In his speech, the president insisted voter registration will start imminently and that nothing can stop the election from happening. But in recent weeks, senior officials close to Kabila have spoken publicly of holding a constitutional referendum first. If the people of Congo want more Kabila, they ask, why should they be denied? Hans Hobeck is a senior Congo analyst at the International Crisis Group.
At the moment, the voter registration will reach its end. I'm sure this will become a concrete proposal. Yeah. If they get away with prolonging the rain, if the people remain, generally speaking, quiet, then I think they're going to try it. I'm not saying that they're going to succeed, but I think they're going to try it.
And there is recent precedent. The leaders of two of the DRC's neighbours, Congo-Brazzaville and Rwanda, have successfully removed term limits through referendums and won fresh terms in office in the past year. For more than a year, Kabila has invited the opposition to participate in a political dialogue. Edem Kodjo, a former Togolese prime minister, is facilitating the efforts on behalf of the African Union. Most influential opposition leaders remain publicly hostile to Kabila's offer. They dismissed the dialogue as a trap and have begun to ask for US involvement on the facilitation panel. But qualified support can be found. Juvenal Manubu is a parliamentarian from one of the largest opposition parties. He told VOA that a dialogue acceptable to all sides is the country's last chance and must provide clear answers to 2 essential questions. On what date shall the presidential election take place? And who shall lead the DRC once Kabila's elected mandate expires on December 19th? For Manubu, if these questions can be answered, the main problems disappear and the election need not take place in 2016. More time could work in the opposition's favour. At present, there is no obvious opposition presidential candidate, and the separate coalitions are still trying to form a united front. Moise Katumbi points to the size of the fight on their hands. as yet the only politician to declare his intention to contest the presidential election, Katumbi has left the DRC in May. He was subject to two sets of legal charges, one of them over the alleged hiring of mercenaries. In June, he was sentenced in absentia to 3 years in prison. Returning home to campaign is currently out of the question. Katumbi issued his own Independence Day statement. He said Kabila must leave power this year. He also condemned the charges against him as a crude means of preventing his candidature. The government has brushed it off, calling Katumbi's statement a pathetic diatribe. William Clowes for VOA News, Kinshasa.
A Zambian police official says the police force will carry out its mandate to enforce the law irrespective of the political party. Ray Hamonga, deputy spokesperson for the police, made his remarks after Zambians complained about the escalating violence allegedly carried out by supporters of the ruling Patriotic Front Party and partisans of the main opposition United Party for National Development. Hamonga told me the police will not tolerate any act of violence in the run-up to the polls.
Even though we are in the campaign period, we know that the crime is still in our midst. Now, as regards to issues relating to political cadres clashing, this is actually also a wake-up call for the political leaders themselves to remind their cadres that Zambia is a multi-party state. And that being the case, it means each and every person is free to form a political party. And as such, they should teach or remind their cadres to restrain themselves from attacking other political parties. Because once you attack another person, the same rights that allows you to form a political party are the same rights that allow another person to form a political party.
The police have called on the political leaders to restrain their cadres or supporters. However, this seemed not to have worked. What is the other plan for the police to curb this violence or prevent it from escalating as the situation is now?
These political cadres are very loyal to their leaders. So we have been reminding the leaders to educate their cadres to behave in a normal and civilized way. So what we are doing as police now, because even us as police have been reminding them and issuing warnings, and now right now what we are doing, we are even issuing warnings. If anybody commits a crime now, what we have decided to do is to arrest them. And we have been doing those arrests again.
The opposition parties have accused the police of bias and that their supporters are being clamped down upon, being violently repressed and being prevented from, you know, exercising their fundamental constitutional right in campaigning, free speech, among other issues. How does the police respond to such criticism?
So far, we have arrested the political cadres from both the ruling party and even the opposition. Now, when it comes to the issue of campaigns, in Zambia we have the Public Order Act. Now, this Public Order Act, Chapter 1331, sorry, 113, in that Public Order Act, if somebody wants to hold the public procession in Zambia, say like a public rally, it allows the head of state, the vice president, the Speaker of the National Assembly, and the deputy, and the ministers not to notify the police of their intentions of holding any public procession or a meeting. Now, the political parties that are in this country, like the opposition, they feel that when we tell them that this law, the president enjoys the right of not notifying the police, because it's assumed that a head of state holds the interest of the whole nation. So there's no any single person that can stand on the way of the head of state holding the interest of the nation. So that is where at times we have had the people think that maybe the police is bad. Let me give you a practical example. For instance, if you want to intend to have a meeting at a particular location, and the president also wants to have a meeting there, what the law demands is that you step aside and give preference to the head of state. And thereafter, you can have your meeting after the head of state had his meeting there. And this is the bottom contention that the opposition have been saying the police is bad. We are, right now, as I'm talking to you, we have got political candidates that actually were involved in these criminal activities or political violence that have appeared in the course of the both from the ruling party and from the opposition.
Talking about accusations of bias, the UPND has accused the police of ransacking its office, breaking into its office, carrying out equipment without explaining what you are going to do, and that this was just a campaign office they used to coordinate their activities, and that it was illegal for the police to enter and ransack the place without any warrant.
The police is mandated by law, of course, to enter the premises legally. When I mean legally, by way of obtaining a search warrant, to search a place where they suspect that there is something that's suspecting. But in this instance, the police got a search warrant and went to search that place, and they have seized some things, and of course, there are still, some articles, and our investigation on that matter are still going on. And for fear of jeopardizing our investigation, I'm not divulged much, but I just watch the space. Within a short period of time, maybe in the next 2 or 3 days, we'll be able to give a complete, even if by tomorrow, we'll give a complete statement over this matter.
Ray Hamonga is the deputy spokesperson for the Zambian police. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Puntland President Abdiwele Mohamed Ali says he is fully engaged in the battle against Al-Shabaab in Somalia. In fact, he recently vowed that Al-Shabaab prisoners could be executed in revenge for the targeted killings against his people. For more, I caught up with President Ali during his recent visit to Washington, D.C.
My main focus for coming here was to engage the Puntland diaspora, Somali diaspora, in the United States of America and also in Canada, Northern America.
Looking at Puntland, what is the relevance of Puntland in the fight against terrorism, particularly Al-Shabaab?
You know, Puntland is one third of the Somali territory and almost one third of the Somali population. It's strategically located, bordering both the Indian Ocean and the Red Sea. We are bordering Yemen, which is now a huge problem, you know, the issue of Yemen. And the Indian Ocean. So we are fighting against piracy, we are fighting against illegal migration, we are fighting against Al-Shabaab, a terrorist organization who was wreaking havoc in that part of the world. It's a global phenomenon. It's not a Somali problem. It's not a regional problem. Actually, it's a huge international problem. So Puntland is very important. And we are looking the international community, our international partners, to help us, all these menace, all these non-state actors who are creating problems for peace and stability in the region and also for peace and stability in worldwide.
How do you cooperate with the government in Mogadishu in this regard to address the problem of insecurity, particularly Al-Shabaab?
Of course, this is a common enemy, so therefore we should have a common strategy. And we are working together with the federal government, and we want to face this as a united Somalia. This enemy doesn't care whether you are from the south or from the east or from the west or from the north. It's un-Islamic. It's given a bad name to Islam. It's given a bad name to our culture and religion. And so we have to be united against it. So we have no choice but to work together.
So looking forward, what are the prospects of peace returning to Somalia as a whole?
I'm very optimistic about the future of Somalia. You know, the Somali society are very strong, very vibrant, very resilient. And this is a long war. But at the same time, if you look where we came from, in a difficult civil war, to warlordism, to Islamic Courts Union, to traditional federal governments, and now we have a full governance in Somalia. So if you look where we came from, where we are today, it's an oceans apart. But still, we have more to do. We have to liberate the country from the yoke of Al-Shabaab. We have to stabilize the country. We have to build all the regional administrations so all the Somalis have semblance of governance everywhere in Somalia. And then to govern the country democratically where everybody has a vote and a voice. Okay? This is the ultimate dream of Somalia. We can take this country forward.
Finally, what would be the message for your people in Puntland and as a whole in Somalia?
My mission is always simple. We have to unite. United we stand, divided we fall. We have to unite for the sake of the common good. We have to unite to liberate our country from these enemies. So unity and stability can take the country forward.
Thank you very much, Mr. President.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
That was Puntland President Abdiweli Mohamed Ali. He spoke with me from here at the VOA studios in Washington, D.C. During his work on a documentary about Muslims in Europe entitled Journey into Europe, Professor Akbar Ahmed, Chair of Islamic Studies at the American University in Washington, came across African immigrants who have different reasons for immigration compared to the Muslim immigrants of Arab descent. He told viewers Mohammed El Shinawi about his findings.
We traveled not only to Eastern Europe and Southern Europe, we went to Africa. We traveled to Melia, which is a part of Spain but still on the African continent. And in Sicily, in Italy, we interviewed several African immigrants. One of them in particular, who's in the film, Emadu, is a 16-year-old boy from the Gambia who had traveled across the Sahara. Took him over a year to travel and turned up in Sicily, which is where we met him. It's a very powerful, very moving story, and I hope that story helps explain the story and the predicament and the reason why so many Africans are leaving home to try to come to Europe and try to earn some living so they can then in turn help people back home, where you have all kinds of problems, both political, economic, and even social.
How would you compare challenges facing Muslims coming from Africa into Europe compared to Arab Muslims?
It's a very interesting question. The Arabs coming to Europe are coming for directly political reasons. The vast majority of Syrians arriving in Europe are coming because of the civil war taking place in Syria. So they're escaping a situation. They're seeking shelter. They're not primarily coming to Europe. Millions are going to Turkey and Jordan and Lebanon, but a lot of them are also coming to Europe. The Africans are coming for a very different reason. They're coming primarily to escape economic poverty and political chaos at home. So they're coming hoping to establish themselves, earn some money, and eventually go back or send the money back home so that their families can live a better life. So two very different reasons. In Europe, of course, people see immigrants in one category. They see them all as immigrants. And the patience of a lot of Europeans have been very, very generous, like the Greeks or the Italians, who do not have a particularly healthy economy at this stage. You know, there's high unemployment, economic crisis. They themselves are having problems. In spite of that, so many local people have gone out of the way to help immigrants, just simply help them, because they've said, like the mayor of Palermo in Sicily, he says to us, no man is illegal. Every man is legal. He comes here, we must welcome him, because that is the Sicilian tradition. And he's very proud. He says, we have an Arab Islamic presence in Sicily. We're very proud of this culture. So you see, these things we don't know, because these influences form Europe and European culture and how Europeans think of themselves. The right-wing parties in Europe, and now many mainstream Europeans, have two complaints about the Muslims. They say Muslims are not part of Europe, and they say Muslims have not contributed anything to European civilization. Now, my film and my book disprove both points. Muslims have contributed very, very heavily to European culture and civilization. And Muslims have been part of European society and culture for over 1,000 years. People forget that Muslims first came to Europe in 711, in the 8th century, and gave Europe one of its greatest civilizations in Andalusia. Andalusia, with its head capital in Cordoba, was once the most glittering city of all of Europe. People forget this. And it was a Muslim kingdom.
That was Professor Akbar Ahmed, Chair of the Islamic Studies Department at American University in Washington. He spoke with viewers Mohammed El Shinawi. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sport. In football, Morocco's Wydad Casablanca and South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns won Wednesday's games in the African Champions League. Sundowns beat Enyimba of Nigeria 2-1 in Pretoria. Wild had a 2-0 victory over Zambia's Zesco United in Rabat. Walid Kati's header put Wild in front in the 12th minute, whilst an own goal from David Owino early in the second half gave them the win. The result puts the Moroccans top of Group A with 2 wins in 2 matches. The Wild Casablanca Zesco match on Wednesday ended around midnight owing to the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, during which eating and drinking is forbidden from dawn to dusk. Footballers can be excused, but must observe the first leading to late kickoffs of CAF matches in Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and Egypt. In the other group, Sundowns secured their first points, having had their previous win over Entente Satif annulled after Satif were disqualified following crowd trouble. That win puts Sundowns level with Zamalek at the top of Group B with 1 victory each in a group which is now reduced to 3 teams. Enyimba are bottom, still searching for their first points of the group, having lost both their opening 2 matches. On Tuesday, Ivory Coast's ASEC Mimosa secured a valuable away win over newly crowned Egyptian champions Al Ahly. The Ivorians, who, like Ahly, who had lost their first game of the group stage, secured a 2-1 win in Alexandria, where the Cairo club are playing their continental games. Goals from Yannick Zakri and Amanda Nyanke gave them the victory. Ahly had regained the league title, which they lost to rival Zamalek last season with a win at Ismailia on Sunday. Egypt's Al Ahly are looking to win a 9th African Champions title. Ahly had been Africa's champions a record 8 times, most recently in 2013 when they defeated South African opponents Orlando Pirates 3-1 over 2 legs. Elsewhere, Malawi has fired coach Ernest Ntawali and his assistant Nsanzorino Ramadan, whose contracts were due to expire on July 31st. It follows the Flames' first-round exit from the recent COSAFA Cup in Namibia. Former midfielder, 49-year-old Ntawali, took over the national team in August 2015, but has paid for his record of 6 wins, 6 defeats, and 4 draws. Ramadan will return as caretaker coach, however, to oversee Malawi's match against Swaziland in September. The match to be played on September 3rd in Blantyre is Malawi's last in their failed campaign to qualify for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations. Malawi's chances of making it to next year's finals in Gabon were ended in June when they were beaten by Zimbabwe in Harare. Malawi are bottom of Group L with only 2 points. And in athletics, 6-time Olympic gold medalist Usain Bolt has suffered an injury scare ahead of Rio after tearing a hamstring at Jamaica's Olympic trials. The 29-year-old Bolt sustained a grade 1 tear during the first round of the 100 meters and withdrew after winning his semi-final. He's still expected to defend his 100 and 200-meter titles as Jamaica's selection policy allows medical exemptions. In the double world champions scare, the 100 meters final in Kingston was won by London 2012 silver medalist Johan Blake in a time of 9.95 seconds. Meanwhile, Sanya Richards-Ross will not defend her 400-meter title in Rio after pulling out of the U.S. Olympic trials in Eugene, Oregon. The 31-year-old, who will retire at the end of the season, dropped out after 250 meters of her heat with a hamstring injury. Finally, in tennis, Novak Djokovic is out of Wimbledon after a shock defeat by American Sam Querrey, ending the world's number one's hopes of a calendar year Grand Slam. Querrey, seeded 28th, completed a 7-6, 6-1, 7-6 third-round win after rain and suspended play on Friday evening. It was the Serb's first loss at a major since the 2015 French Open final. Britain's Andy Murray, seeded second, made it into round four with a 6-3, 7-5, 6-2 win over Australia's John Millman. Djokovic had hoped to win his third straight Wimbledon title and secure the third leg of a calendar slam. The 29-year-old has already won the Australian and French Opens this year and was also trying to become only the second man to win five consecutive major titles. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now, back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Baby, I see something beautiful for your back. We'll be right back. ne mukambi yangu ya nyonso ngayo
And that was our Sunday music spot. I hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one more point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. After 13 years of deployment, United Nations peacekeeping operation in Liberia has completed its operation and is withdrawing. There are, however, some Liberians who are concerned that the withdrawal might endanger security, particularly in light of the forthcoming legislative and presidential elections. The leadership of the security forces in Liberia do believe that it is timely for the United Nations forces to withdraw, and they are confident that they will be able to provide necessary security. With respect to security during elections, the leadership have noted that in the past they have provided security for elections, although they will sorely miss the logistical support of the United Nations during elections. It is never an easy matter for the people of countries where UN is deployed to accept immediately the withdrawal of the forces, except perhaps when you think about the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where the people and the government have been asking for the withdrawal of UN forces. In Sierra Leone, we had a similar phenomenon. The people and some UN officials wanted to prolong the UN forces to ensure greater security. However, the late President Tidjane Kabah, who was very familiar with the United Nations practice and principles, felt that the UN should withdraw on the grounds that continued deployment of UN forces in Sierra Leone might deter investors to come in, fearing that the presence of UN force implies insecurity in the country. Now, with the departure of UN forces from Liberia, we are ending an era in the sub-region where the presence of UN peacekeeping forces were dominant. We have seen the UN involved not only in Liberia and Sierra Leone, but also in La Côte d'Ivoire. And, of course, their involvement in the ouster of Gbagbo was rather controversial. Overall, the UN forces have played a very useful role. But people of the sub-region should never forget that the foundation for the security in the sub-region in the turbulent period was set by ECOMOG, the imaginative peacekeeping force of ECOWAS. ECOWAS was able to end almost genocide in Liberia and then lay the foundations for security. And in Sierra Leone, with meager resources, ECOMOG helped to save the sovereignty of Sierra Leone. It is hard to imagine what would have happened if ECOMOG had not been able to establish control in Lungé. It was that control of Lungé that enabled ECOMOG to end the coup d'etat in 1998. But as we appreciate the value of ECOMOG and value of the United Nations, governments in the sub-region must begin to contemplate how best they can figure out establishing a credible sub-regional peacekeeping operation, particularly when we see what is happening in Mali, where the United Nations force is encountering serious problems of security. In East Africa, they have made great strides in putting together a regional peacekeeping force. And I think it is necessary at this stage for the governments to begin planning. One thing that is credible, though, is that because of the services of the UN forces in the sub-region, countries like Nigeria, Ghana, and Sierra Leone have been able to be troop contributors of United Nations forces in other parts of Africa, particularly in Somalia. So as we say goodbye to the UN forces in Liberia, let us pledge that conditions will not develop that may require further development of UN forces in the sub-region. I thank you.
That was one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. And from the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter and producer for today, Douglas Impuga, and our engineer is Michael Dubinsky. We say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, quarrels end, but words once spoken never die. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
4 years ago, determined to end preventable child deaths within a generation, the United States, Ethiopia, and India joined UNICEF to rally the world behind the Child Survival Call to Action, a sustained global effort to save the lives of children under the age of five. The goal was to lower child mortality rates in the hardest-hit countries to 20 deaths per 1,000 live births by the year 2035, and to continue progress in those nations already below that rate. Out of this grew Acting on the Call, Ending Preventable Child and Maternal Deaths, a USAID-led initiative that identified 24 high-priority countries, which together accounted for 70% of all child and maternal deaths, and developed for them results-oriented plans to meet these targets. And as a result, children are surviving at a rate never seen before, while fewer mothers are dying due to complications from pregnancy and childbirth. Since 2008, USAID's efforts in the 24 priority countries have helped save the lives of 4.6 million children and 200,000 women. Last year saw some particularly impressive results. So, for example, newborn deaths dropped by 13% in target facilities in India. 95% of Tanzania's previously unprotected children living in areas where immunization rates have been lowest have been vaccinated. And for the first time ever, all of the Democratic Republic of the Congo received malaria program coverage. And we are hoping to do even better. USAID's drive to end preventable child and maternal deaths focuses on the poorest 40% of the population in priority countries, in hopes of saving the lives of 8 million mothers and children from this segment of the population by 2020. and the program will expand to another priority country, Burma. We've taken a challenge that was once too big to tackle and turned it into a solvable problem, said USAID Administrator Gail Smith. We can measure our progress against achievable targets. We can apply interventions where the evidence tells us they will have the greatest impact. We're building momentum that I'm confident will carry us over the finish line, a world where preventable maternal and child deaths are actually prevented.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.